that I no longer see it the way I used to. Other things have filled the hole, the love I feel for others and the love they feel for me. Places dear to my heart, books and words that have gentled me, the sound of the ocean, the smell of freshly turned soil, the beauty of flowers, my daughter's laugh, in ways unexpected. I see the hole differently because I have thought deeply about its effect on me and have come to appreciate the woman I became as well as the child and young adult I once was. One question I often field from readers is this one. Don't you ever wonder who you might have been if your mother had been loving? Actually, I don't, because the question doesn't lead me or you anywhere productive. It's no different from wondering what my life would have been like if I'd been blonde and petite instead of dark and tall, if I'd been possessed of great musical talent instead of being utterly tone-deaf, if I'd been a brilliant mathematician or a brilliant anything instead of a reasonably smart person. We can't change the facts of our lives, but what is productive is looking back at your behaviors in the past and recognizing the degree to which your childhood experiences drove the choices you made and the people you chose to be with. If you can do that objectively without falling into the habit of self-criticism or beating yourself up, it can permit you to own the narrative of your life in a way that you haven't before. Journaling, connecting the dots. If you haven't been journaling, now is definitely the time to start. And if you have been, it's a good time for a brand new notebook to write in. Part of recovery entails continuing to refine our understanding of the pivotal events in our lives and seeing them as part of a coherent narrative. The act of connecting the dots functions the way the shiny lacquer used in kintsugi fills the cracks in a damaged ceramic object. Do journal about the present, focusing on how your current behavior is becoming increasingly separated from your past. That will permit you to segregate those recurrent behaviors so you can focus on changing them. Mourning the mother you deserved. Will I ever stop feeling I was cheated of something essential? Even at age 59, it makes me angry, and my mother died over 10 years ago. Priscilla. The road that is recovery from a childhood without a mother's love, support, and attunement is long and complicated. One aspect of healing that is rarely touched upon is mourning the mother you needed, sought, and, yes, deserved. The word deserved is a key to understanding why this remains elusive for many women. They simply don't see themselves as deserving because they've internalized what their mother said and did as self-criticism and have wrongly concluded that they're lacking, worthless, or simply unlovable. When I cut my mother out of my life some 13 years before her actual passing, I began the process of mourning the mother I deserved, which had nothing to do with the woman who gave birth to me. It was what I needed to do to let go and move on, especially because I was about to become a mother myself. By mourning the mother I needed, I validated my unmet needs as well as my feelings. Losses in life must be mourned, and research shows that ritualized mourning promotes healing. Why it's important to mourn the mother you needed, and why it can be so hard. Grieving the mother you needed is impeded both by feeling unworthy of love and by the core conflict. Those who concede the battle, going no contact or limiting communication with their mothers, and usually other family members, experience great loss along with relief. For the daughter to heal, this loss, the death of the hope that this essential relationship can be salvaged, needs to be mourned along with the mother she deserved and didn't get. The depth of the core conflict can be glimpsed in the anguish of those daughters who stay in the relationship precisely because they fear they will feel worse when their mothers die. Meg's words echo those of others. If I cut her off and she dies, I'm scared I'll feel even more pain than I do now. What if she changed and came to her senses and I missed it? Then it would be my fault, the way she always said it was. Mourning the mother you needed and deserved shifts the focus to you and away from the mother you had. Let's look at what mourning entails because, again, it's a process, not a single step. We can't just light a candle and be done with it. The stages of grief echo the process of a daughter's recovery from childhood. In their book on grief and grieving, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and co-author David Kessler point out that the five stages of loss for which Kubler-Ross is famous, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, aren't meant to help tuck messy emotions into neat packages. They emphasize that everyone experiences grief in a unique and individual way. Not everyone will go through each stage, for example, and the stages may not necessarily follow in the expected sequence. That said, these stages are nonetheless illuminating, especially when seen in the context of an unloved daughter's journey out of childhood, and make it clear why mourning is an essential part of healing. Denial. As the authors write, it is nature's way of letting in as much as we can handle. With the experience of great loss, denial helps cushion the immediate blow, allowing the person to pace the absorption of the reality. That's true for death, but it also applies to the daughter's recognition of her woundedness. That's why it can take years or decades for the daughter to actually see her mother's behavior with clarity. Counterintuitively, some women actually only see it in hindsight, after their mother's deaths. Anger. In the wake of death, anger is the most accessible of emotions, directed at targets as various as the deceased for abandoning the loved one, God or the forces of the universe, the unfairness of life, doctors and the healthcare system, and more. Kubler-Ross and Kessler stress that beneath the anger lie other, more complex emotions, especially the raw pain of loss, and that the power of the grieving person's anger may actually feel overwhelming at times. Unloved daughters, too, go through a stage or even stages of anger as they work through their emotions toward recovery. Their anger may be directed squarely at their mothers for their treatment, at other family members who stood by and failed to protect them, and also at themselves for not recognizing the toxic treatment sooner. Anger at the self, alas, can get in the way of the daughter's ability to feel self-compassion. Once again, it is the act of mourning the mother you deserved that permits self-compassion to take root and flower. That said, continuing to feel anger at your mother's treatment of you will keep you stuck emotionally. See more on this in the section titled Acceptance. Bargaining. This stage usually has to do with impending death, bargaining with God, or making promises to change, thinking that if only we'd done X or Y, we'd be spared the pain of loss. With death, this is a stage to be passed through toward acceptance of the reality. The unloved daughter's journey is marked by years of bargaining, spoken or unspoken entreaties, in the belief that if some condition is met, her mother will love and support her. She may embark on a course of pleasing and appeasing her mother, or make changes to her behavior, looking in vain for the solution that will bring the desired end, her mother's love. Just as in the process of grief, it's only when the daughter ceases to bargain that she can begin to accept the reality that she's powerless to wrest what she needs from her mother. Depression. In the context of a major loss, Kubler-Ross and Kessler are quick to point out that we are often impatient with the deep sadness or depression that accompanies it. As a society, we want people to snap out of it or are quick to insist that if sadness persists, it deserves treatment. They write instead that in grief, depression is a way for nature to keep us protected by shutting down the nervous system so that we can adapt to something we feel we cannot handle. They see it as a necessary step in the process of healing. Since I'm neither a psychologist nor a therapist, I'm staying out of the fray. The terrain for the unloved daughter is equally tricky. It's normal to feel sad, even depressed, by your mother's treatment of you. This sadness is often given more depth by feelings of isolation, believing you're the only unloved girl in the world, and shame. The shame emerges from the mother myths that all mothers are loving, and the unloved daughter's worry that she's to blame for how her mother treats her. Just as well-meaning people try to push and prod mourners out of this stage of grief, so too many friends and acquaintances in whom the daughter confides unwittingly marginalize her sadness, saying things like, "It couldn't have been so bad because you turned out so well," and other comments of that ilk. Side note, I have heard this too many times to count. It's the subject of emails I receive from readers who insist my mother must have been a doll. Acceptance. Most important, Kubler-Ross and Kessler are quick to say that acceptance of the reality isn't a synonym for being all right or even okay with that reality. That's a key point. It's about acknowledging the loss, identifying the permanent and even endlessly painful aspects of it, the permanent changes it's made to your life and you, and learning to live with all of that from this day forward. In their view, acceptance permits us to withdraw our energies from the loss and begin to invest in life. Acceptance permits the mourner to forge new relationships and connections as part of their recovery. All of this applies to unloved daughters as well, though acceptance remains, for many, somehow out of reach. This is why, once again, the need to mourn the mother you deserved is crucial to acceptance. Acceptance does not mean to forgive, excuse, deny, or paper over. It means saying to yourself, "It is what it is, and it's about her, not me. I don't have the power to change it or her, only myself." What does it mean to mourn the mother you deserved? Just what it sounds like. To grieve the absence of a mother who listened to you, took pride in you, who needed you to understand her as well as she understood you. A woman willing to own up to her mistakes and not excoriate you for yours, and yes, someone to laugh and cry with. I look at my relationship with my own daughter, and sometimes I can see how my younger self would have envied her. Even now, it's difficult to look past how my mother squandered countless opportunities. Chief among them was actually knowing me. Studies show that rituals help us deal with loss because performing rituals, literally deciding to take action in the wake of calamity, helps make us feel more in control. A loss of any kind in life robs us of the sense of control, whether it's a literal death or a symbolic one, such as the death or end of a relationship, the death of the hope that a relationship can be salvaged or repaired, or the final dashing of a long-held dream or goal. Ritual is as old as humanity itself, and indeed, all religions incorporate ritual for this very reason: to aid and support transition and grieving at a time of loss. That said, we're not talking about religious rituals here. That part is up to you if you choose. But personal rituals. If this sounds a bit too new agey for you, let me begin with the science. In a series of experiments, Michael I. Norton and Francesca Gino looked at whether personal rituals actually alleviated feelings of grief. Personal rituals, as described by the participants who experienced loss, were wide-ranging and very individual indeed. For example, one person wrote a letter to her ex-lover and never mailed it, but later destroyed it to symbolize letting go, while those whose partners had died remembered them in specific ways, such as playing a favorite song and thinking and crying about the loved one, or doing something the person used to do. The researchers found that, indeed, enacting rituals alleviated grief and didn't depend on the person's actually believing in the efficacy of rituals either. Additionally, they found that the specific behaviors that comprised the ritual were less important than performing some kind of ritual behavior. You can make up your own rituals, of course, or you might want to perform a variation on any of these suggestions. Letting go. In order to mourn the mother you deserved, you need to let go of the mother you had and all the complicated feelings the relationship engendered. You can write a letter to your mother and then burn it in a fireproof container, as one reader did, or toss it into a fireplace if you have one. You can also burn a photograph or image that is emblematic of the relationship. Writing down all your emotions, such as fear, anger, shame, anxiety, and the like, on slips of paper and burning them can also be a ritual. Similarly, cutting an item of clothing or fabric into small pieces and then disposing of them ritualistically, burying them, for example, or choosing a specific place to throw them away, is another way of letting go, especially if the item has some sort of emotional history or meaning. Water is highly symbolic, necessary for life in all of its forms. Cleansing, an emblem of change and movement, and used in rituals the world over. You can literally wash your hands of your childhood experiences or anything else you need to shed. This is something I do with the help of lavender and some other scented soap. If you are lucky enough to live near a body of water, tossing stones into the water and saying words as you do, now I am letting go of the bad times with you. Now my focus is off the past and on the present and future. This pebble represents the shame and fear I learned as a child and now let go of. Could be very powerful. Do what feels right for you. Lighting candles plays a significant role in rituals all over the world, and many people incorporate them into a personal ritual. Do remember to use them safely. Never leave a burning candle unattended, and always place it well away from anything flammable. Candles symbolically and literally illuminate the space, casting out darkness so you can light them ceremonially to celebrate letting go of your old behaviors or losing the internalized critical voice. Colored candles can also be used symbolically. Red is a symbol of love, passion, and anger. White is associated with knowledge and deliberation. Blue stands for the sky, the heavens, spirit, and intellect. And purple, which is a blend of blue and red, symbolizes the connection between earth and heaven and the balance of passion and intellect. Mourning the mother you deserved. The act of mourning the mother you didn't get puts your needs center stage where they should be and will help you manage the complex emotions that are aroused by the recognition. Begin by visualizing this mother and what it would have been like to be in her presence. You can draw on qualities you admire in women and men you know that you associate with good mothering, caring, kindness, and attunement. You can also use memories of those who were safe havens in your childhood or who were simply kind to you. When I visualize the mother I needed, I see someone who is a good listener and kind. If she has one essential quality, it is that she's genuinely interested in me, who I am, what I'm thinking, why I'm drawn to some things and not to others. She's someone who feels good about herself without needing to put others down, open to new experiences, and thoughtful. If I had been her daughter, I'd have been me, but a better version of myself, and much earlier in life. Here are some possibilities for you to explore as you mourn the mother you needed. Write about her, especially what it was like to be with her. Use your journal to imagine what your life and interactions might have been like if you had the mother you needed. This exercise shines a different light on your experiences and permits you to experience a sense of loss that is more healing than not. Create an altar or collage. gathering objects that you find beautiful, inspiring, or calming, or ones that symbolize maternal love, and arranging them in a meaningful way to express your thoughts, can be another way of expressing what you missed. Similarly, you can collect images to create a collage that does much the same thing. Compile a collection of quotations. Finding the right words to describe the emotional connection you needed doesn't come easily to everyone, so using other people's words may help you give voice to your thoughts and feelings and help you process. You can collect these sayings in your journal or handwrite them on pieces of paper and paste or tape them to a piece of foam board or cardboard. You can frame it, too. One of the nice things about this exercise is that it enables self-mothering and compassion because it has you thinking about the positive and transformative power of love. Shifting perspective. What your mother missed by not loving you. I find this hard to contemplate. I don't care what my mother missed out on. That's for her to lament, which I don't think she really does, or if she does, she blames me as the cause. I care far more about all the time and energy I wasted. There's your wastefulness theme, trying to win her love, be worthy of her time and attention. Suzanne, 49. Once you have begun the process of mourning and worked hard at letting go of the emotions that get in your way, I would encourage you to try this shift in perspective. Focusing on what your mother missed out on by not loving you or seeing you as you truly are. Now, this is an imaginative exercise since it's likely your mother never, ever thinks about you in this way, and given the horrified response I got from readers when I first posed the question on Facebook, I am guessing you are saying no either under your breath or out loud and maybe shaking your head. But here's the thing. If you are thoughtful and reflective, revisiting pivotal moments and experiences in your life will occasionally yield a new perspective. Given my work, I actually believed that the dust had pretty much settled and that I had gleaned every possible insight from the wreckage that was my childhood. Well, never say never. This exercise is based on my own epiphany of several years ago. The utter wastefulness of the unloving mother and her willful squandering of a unique relationship. I lay the blame for the waste at the mother's feet because she alone has the power to shape the relationship during a daughter's childhood and after. That's where we started in Chapter 1, remember? I understood this with utter clarity on a trip to Amsterdam, my mother's hometown, with my own daughter, then almost 28. We were on our way to Artis, the zoo, one of my mother's favorite destinations. While she didn't love me, she adored animals. The rain had actually stopped, and the sun was shining. We were walking along streets as familiar to me as those in New York, my hometown, talking and laughing. It struck me how lucky I was to have such a smart, perceptive, and funny companion to spend my time with. That I'd had a hand in her creation seemed nothing short of miraculous. And then, it hit me. This was precisely what my mother missed because she threw it away. By the time I was my daughter's age, I had broken off all connection to my mother for perhaps the second or third time. That cutoff lasted 2 years or so, and the final one was still a decade away. Appreciating my daughter, I really felt the wastefulness of my mother's actions and behaviors without pitying her. In a world where true connection is so maddeningly elusive, love is hard to find and even harder for most of us to hold on to. My mother's stubborn insistence that I was lacking, unlovable, and had nothing to offer her or anyone else seemed all the more unfathomable in light of my relationship to the granddaughter she never knew. There's no doubt that this epiphany has much to do with how old I am. It's not something I would have understood when I was younger, or, for that matter, when my daughter was younger. I just didn't have the perspective. I am no longer the wounded child who longed for my mother's love, though I will go to my grave mourning the love I deserved and didn't get. My own role as a mother of a daughter has long since eclipsed the emotional importance of being my mother's child. This makes it possible for me to consider what my mother missed in not loving me, without giving her a pass or an ounce of forgiveness. But thinking about her wastefulness put the focus on me in a different way. It's now easy to see that I was just as cute, funny, and smart then as my kid is today, except my mother was too jealous and hateful to see it. She took my accomplishments as an affront, unless she could use them to aggrandize herself. If you believe that you are ready, I think this can be a useful exercise. Only you can judge your own readiness to think about your mother in this theoretical way. Remember that most unloving mothers never acknowledge their behavior, so the idea of their addressing what they missed is more or less a fantasy. Their denial is too great. But I think that in the recovery stage, there's value to seeing what your mother lost. Being able to shift perspective, going from grasping what you needed and were denied, to recovering and healing, to pivoting and seeing what she missed, is like seeing the valley from within it to seeing it from the high hills or mountains that surround it. Are you game to pivot? In answer to the question, what did your mother miss out on? One of my readers posted, I read this and immediately began to cry. What a new idea for me. My mom missed out. I've been so focused on how I've missed out on having a loving mother. But it also touches me deeply because it touches that core belief that I am unworthy and makes me think, maybe I'm not unworthy. Many took it as an opportunity to catalog their gifts and strengths, which I would encourage you to do as well. She missed knowing me, knowing how generous and loyal I am. She missed my empathy, my sense of humor, my drive. She missed the opportunity to be loved unconditionally, or as unconditionally as possible. My mother has missed out knowing what a loving daughter she had in me. But it was never acknowledged, for whatever reason. I could have made her life much easier, or should I say, much more fulfilled as a mother of seven. I am generous to a fault, but that much she did know about me, and she used it against me. Does this make sense? In a thoroughly unscientific way, I've rounded up the main themes daughters raised in thinking about what their mothers lost by being unloving. There are many more, of course. If you are ready to think about this, it's a reflection that can yield a great deal of clarity. Remember that this isn't an exercise meant to make you feel sorry for your mother, but to strengthen your own self-compassion, encourage you to mother yourself, and to see yourself as you truly are. Sharing in her daughter's life. Yes, here is the great payoff for a loving mother. To see the child you've brought into the world make her own choices, succeed, and sometimes stumble, and be a part of it all. Really knowing her child. Being intimate with anyone is a terrific opportunity to move past the confines of our own skins and ways of perceiving the world. But there is something very special about knowing someone from the very beginning. This is undoubtedly biased, but the world gets brighter when I see the daughter I know and love. Her insights and reactions remind me of the limitations of my own points of view and help me, even at this age, to keep on growing. Watching her daughter flower and seeing the role she played. There's an enormous difference between seeing your child as an extension of yourself or someone you have to mold into shape, as some unloving mothers do, and playing the role of gardener as your child grows. A good gardener provides her with the love, support, resources, and protection she needs to become herself. And yes, it's fine to feel pride in what you've been able to give your daughter. One daughter offered this insight. My mother had me because it was the thing to do. She missed the look of love in a child's eye. A warm hug, endless artwork made at school or at home. Mother's Day cards, which were made from love, not forced because of another adult telling me I had to do it. Little love notes under a pillow, because little daughters are silly that way. Tea parties and long walks of where fairies come from. She missed me. But the world has me now. I just need to be a shining star for myself and my daughters. Having fun and joy with, and because of, her daughter. Yes, the dismissive, hypercritical, absent, or it's all about me mothers miss out on the fabulous company an adult daughter can be. I'm not being a Pollyanna here and saying my daughter never makes me crazy or that we never fight. We do. The arguments are epic when they happen, but we easily resolve them. The rest, folks, is what my mother missed. The stuff of life that fills your heart with joy and puts a smile on your very soul. As one 30-year-old daughter put it, well, I think that she missed out on a wonderful friendship. I have a couple of girlfriends who have really great and fun relationships with their moms. I was jealous of how easy, nurturing, and natural these relationships were. The relationship I had with my mother was mostly insufferable, so all my life I was jealous of my friends because my mom wasn't my friend. I couldn't talk to her about anything. I couldn't share with her my insecurities. I couldn't count on her support. She was cold. She was judgmental. She was hypercritical, and a lot of the time, she was downright mean. Had she been an actual friend or boyfriend, I would have dumped her a long time ago. So my mom missed out on what could have been a warm and wonderful friendship, a friendship that could have added more meaning and fullness to her life. In the end, here's the truth. You weren't the only one who missed out, really. Keep it in mind on your journey toward healing. The thorny question of forgiveness. I think forgiveness is a personal choice, and there is no yes or no answer. For me, personally, I think that no matter how I or anyone else defines the word forgiveness, to me, it feels like it excuses what was done, and I just can't use that word. Leslie, 41. There's probably no subject more fraught than the question of forgiveness in any situation where you feel deeply wronged or betrayed. It's especially true when the question is asked apropos of a mother whose cardinal responsibility was to love and take care of you, and who failed you in ways that matter, the effects of which stay with you from childhood into adulthood. To err is human, to forgive divine, wrote Alexander Pope, echoing what is essentially a cultural trope. The ability to forgive, particularly in the wake of egregious hurt or violation, is usually understood as a marker of moral and spiritual evolution, and is endowed with specific authority by its inclusion in the Judeo-Christian tradition and specifically in the Lord's Prayer. Recognizing the cultural bias is important, since the unloved daughter will feel the pressure to forgive her mother. It can come from close friends, acquaintances, relatives, strangers, and sometimes even a therapist. Her efforts to forgive may be fueled by her own need to show herself as morally superior somehow to her mother as well. But even though there seems to be a consensus that forgiveness constitutes the high road, there's also a fair amount of confusion about what forgiveness is and isn't. Does it absolve a person of wrongdoing or excuse her? Or is it about something else? Is forgiveness about the other person, or is it about the person professing it? Is it about letting go of anger? Does forgiving give you an advantage that vengefulness doesn't? Does forgiving someone turn you into a patsy or an enabler? What's the difference between forgiving and forgetting? Do you have to forgive in order to heal? What happens if you can't forgive? These are questions philosophers, psychologists, and ordinary folk like you and me have tried to answer. The psychology of forgiveness. I'm getting to the point of genuine forgiveness because I can't hang on to my abusive past if I want a better future. It doesn't excuse the doing she did to me, but I deserve the freedom to have peace and love in my heart that I never learned from her. Deidre, 50. At the beginning of their history, humans were more likely to survive in groups than as isolated singletons or couples, so it's been proposed that forgiveness emerged as a pro-social behavior. Revenge and retribution doesn't just separate you from the transgressor and his allies, but might, in fact, run counter to the communal interests of the tribe. In an article by Jenny L. Burnett and others, the researchers hypothesized that forgiveness as a strategy might have evolved as a function of calculating the risks of revenge against the possible benefits of the relationship. The thinking would go something like this. The younger guy has poached your mate in your tribe of hunter-gatherers, but it occurs to you that he is also one of the strongest men in the tribe and very useful in flood season. What to do? Use revenge as a deterrent against future encroachments, or bet on the value of his future cooperation and go with forgiveness. In a series of experiments, the team did find that, among the college students who participated, there was a calculation of exploitation risk and relationship value that fostered considering forgiveness. Other studies show that certain personality traits actually make some people more likely to forgive than others, or, more precisely, more prone to believe in forgiveness as a helpful and useful strategy after someone has wronged you. One article by the psychologist Michael McCullough suggests that people who thrive in the realm of relationships are more forgiving. Ditto, people who are emotionally stable and, not surprisingly, those who are more religious and spiritual. The researchers also assert that there are specific psychological processes at play when people forgive. Empathy for the transgressor, the ability to give the transgressor the benefit of the doubt, being generous in both the appraisal of the wrongdoer's behavior and the severity of the wrong itself, and the tendency not to ruminate about the betrayal or wrong. Although the article doesn't mention attachment, it's worth noting that the insecurely attached daughter isn't likely to be able to process events in these ways. A meta-analytic review also suggests that there's a connection between self-control and forgiveness. The thinking here is that since the impulse to be vengeful is more primitive, being constructive instead is a sign of self-control. Frankly, this sounds like the cultural bias at work, but more on that anon. The Kiss of the Porcupine and Other Insights. How can you forgive a mother who not only refuses to acknowledge the hurt you suffered by her actions, but is shocked that you think your childhood was painful and she was cruel to you? I refuse to validate her treatment of me. I choose to self-parent and love the child within. I love her and care for her the way she deserves, with kindness and time and care. This takes so much energy and thought and is at times difficult. If only I was parented well to begin with. How can I possibly let go of myself and prove her right with my forgiveness? I do not hang on a bucket of burden and hate. I have worked through and processed my emotions around my childhood and will continue to do so by keeping the little me close, but I cannot offer forgiveness to her while she is in denial of her mean, cruel treatment of me. Amanda. Frank Fincham, an expert on forgiveness, offers up the image of two kissing porcupines as emblematic of the human conundrum. Imagine the two on a frigid night, snuggling to stay warm, enjoying the closeness, until one's quill pierces the other's skin. Ouch! Since humans are social creatures, we make ourselves vulnerable to the ouch moment in the quest for intimacy. Fincham carefully parses what forgiveness is and isn't, and his definitions may be pertinent to those of you struggling with the question. Forgiveness isn't denial or pretending the hurt didn't happen, but, in fact, confirms the hurt because forgiveness wouldn't otherwise be warranted. Additionally, forgiveness confirms the act or transgression as intentional since unintentional acts don't require forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't, Fincham argues, imply reconciliation or reunion. While it's true that reconciliation requires forgiveness, you can forgive someone and have nothing to do with them in the future. Finally, and this one seems important, forgiveness isn't a single act, but a process. Why? Because it requires managing all the negative emotions that are a consequence of the act and substituting goodwill for the impulse to strike back. It's a process that involves a considerable amount of emotional and cognitive work, and so, as Fincham notes, the statement, "I am trying to forgive you," is especially true and meaningful. The downside to forgiveness. I have forgiven my mother time and time again. I went back hoping for a different outcome, but alas, it never happened that way. I understand that she wasn't born this person, that things happened, choices were made, something is broken inside her. I feel she's too far gone in this persona of me, me, me. It was a revolving door for me. I tried to get away, but then some crisis would arise, and of course I was right there to save the day because that's who I am, and she was my mom. Then the crisis would pass and things went back to normal. I lived it this way for way too long. I have finally cut ties and phone numbers. Susan, 50. Does forgiveness always work? I think you already know the answer to this, either from personal experience or from anecdote. The short answer is no. But let's turn to research and get a bead on the downside to forgiveness. In an article appropriately titled "The Doormat Effect," which can be considered a cautionary tale for daughters who are considering both forgiving their mothers and remaining in the relationship. In a bit of contrarian research, the vast majority of studies look at the benefits of forgiveness. Laura Lukes, Eli Finkel, and others looked at whether forgiveness was as universal a panacea as it appeared. Not altogether surprisingly, they found that forgiveness is only beneficial when certain conditions are met. That is, the transgressor makes amends and works to change his or her behavior. If that happens, then the self-concept and self-respect of the forgiving person remain intact. But when the offender doesn't, or even worse, sees forgiveness as an open invitation to keep breaching the trust in the relationship, the person's self-concept is understandably eroded, and he or she will feel used and stupid. Despite the body of research seeming to recommend forgiveness as a panacea, they wrote, "The responses of both victims and perpetrators are influential following a betrayal. Victims' self-respect and self-concept clarity are determined not only by their own decision whether to forgive or not, but also by their perpetrator's decision whether to act in a manner that signals that the victim will be safe or valued or not. Unless and until your mother has come to the table, openly acknowledged her treatment of you, and has vowed to work with you to change her ways, it may well be that forgiving is just a way of reestablishing your status as a doormat if you are still in contact." The dance of denial and forgiveness. While clinicians and researchers agree that forgiveness of transgressions large and small is a cornerstone of maintaining intimate relationships, especially marriage, certain caveats do apply. The relationship must be one of equals, without an imbalance of power, with equal investment and recognition of the benefits of the connection. By definition, the relationship between the mother and the unloved child isn't one of equals, not even if the daughter is an adult. She still wants and needs the maternal love and support she didn't get. Forgiveness may actually get in the way of the daughter's appreciation of how she's been wounded and her healing. It can become part of the dance of denial, enabling or reanimating the explanations that rationalize and normalize her mother's words and actions. She doesn't know she's hurting me. Her own childhood was lousy, so she doesn't know any better. I'm probably too sensitive, like she says. Because the ability to forgive is considered a sign of moral worthiness, setting you apart from the grudge holders of this world, a daughter may unconsciously believe that showing herself worthy in this way will finally get her what she wants, her mother's love. This is an enormous issue and quandary for unloved daughters whose religious faith encourages forgiveness in every circumstance. So it might not be about whether you forgive your mother, but when you do, and your deepest motivation for doing so. Forgiveness after going no contact. Forgiveness comes with healing, and healing begins with honesty and self-love. And by forgiveness, I don't mean saying, it's okay what you did because I see you just made a mistake and you had no bad intentions. That's the normal kind of forgiveness that we exercise every day, because we, as human, are flawed and we do make mistakes. But this kind of forgiveness is different. This forgiveness is saying, I see the truth of what you did. It was horrible and unacceptable and has caused me irreparable harm, but I am moving on with my healing in life and letting you go. That is the forgiveness I am working towards as I heal from severe trauma. But again, forgiveness is not the goal. Healing is the goal. Forgiveness comes as a result of healing. Amy. Many unloved daughters speak of forgiveness as a final step in letting go. From their descriptions, it's less about forgiving their mothers for their behavior than choosing no longer to focus on them as central to their lives. It's true enough that continuing to feel anger, feeling the active sting of how miserably your mother treated you, the ongoing appreciation of how terribly unfair it was that she was your mother in the first place, keeps you emotionally in the relationship, even if you've abandoned it. In this scenario, forgiveness becomes the ultimate act of disengagement. One daughter, though, was careful to draw a distinction between forgiveness and disengagement, a point of view worth considering. Here's the thing. I'm not turning the other cheek and offering the olive branch ever again. The closest I can get to forgiveness is let go of the story in the Buddhist sense. Ruminating about it builds a rut in the brain, so I stay in the moment. When I catch myself thinking about it, I come back to the present moment, perhaps by focusing on my breath again and again and again, as many times as it takes. Depression is thinking about the past, and anxiety is thinking about the future. Mindfulness has been the answer. Compassion also stops the rut-building process in the brain, so I think about what must have happened to my mother. But I do that for the benefit of my brain. Forgiveness? No. So, finally, the decision whether to forgive your mother is a complex one, and one that depends on motivations and intentions, perhaps more than not. I'm often asked if I've forgiven my mother, who is long gone from this earth, and the truth is that I haven't. I find intentional cruelty toward children an unforgivable act, and she certainly was guilty of that, so no forgiveness there. But if one component of forgiveness is letting go, that's another matter. The truth is that I never, ever think about my mother unless I am writing about her or I do something really nice for my daughter and I remind her to thank Rita Streep. Yes, that's both true and ironic because without her miserable example, I might not have been a dedicated parent. That said, never thinking about your mother in the day-to-day as I do is the ultimate disengagement. Moving forward. Earned security. I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. Therapy's helped enormously, and so has living mindfully. Checking my responses and reactions has become a habit of mind. Sure, there are lapses, but my life is so much better, happier now. April, 47. While there's no magic eraser to wipe the chalkboard of childhood clean, your attachment style isn't set in stone, as many studies show. We can thank the brain, that ever-plastic piece of equipment lodged in our skull, for this gift. By making sense of your childhood experiences, you can actually begin to see the world of relationship as a securely attached person does. This is what psychologists call earned security. All the work you have done and continue to do in terms of making the narrative of your childhood experiences coherent, bringing your unconscious patterns of behavior into consciousness and disarming them, and learning to change your behavior moves you in the direction of earned security. But for earned security to become your new default setting, an attuned relationship with a therapist, a mentor, a close friend, a spouse, appears to be necessary for the reset to happen fully. In an article called The Verdict is In, Alan Sroof and Daniel Siegel write, "The brain continues to remodel itself in response to experiences throughout our lives, and emerging understanding of neuroplasticity is showing us how relationships can stimulate neuronal activity and even remove the sympathetic legacy of early social experience." In other words, the unconscious mental representations formed in childhood can be overwritten and edited on a neural level by relationships in adulthood. The authors also point out that even with a largely negative history, there are islands of positive relational history that can be cultivated and grown through therapy. That's precisely what two studies conducted by Maria Zaccanino, Martina Cuscino, Rachel Saunders and others showed when they measured the effect of alternative caregiving figures on adult attachment styles. Yes, participants were able to move to earned secure status. An interesting perspective is offered by Judith R. Shore and Alan N. Shore, which may be of use as you move forward in recovery. They rightly point out that attachment theory is really a regulation theory, since the child learns to self-regulate through dyadic interaction with her mother, which is largely communicated by and through bodily gestures such as eye contact, touching, and smiling. Words are not the primary form of communication. The authors assert that this dynamic of the expressed but unspoken is also key to successful therapeutic treatment. I suspect it's equally true of any relationship that can make the daughter rewrite her emotional history. Think about the islands, both past and present in your life. Those relationships that have made you feel cared about, listened to, and heard, and that allowed you to give voice to yourself. And use them as springboards into the future. These relationships could be ones you had with a cousin, an aunt or grandparent, a teacher, a camp counselor or spiritual guide, a close friend, a spouse, or anyone who has truly heard and seen you and gotten who you really are in the course of your life. Since your goal is to move away from the older attachment styles, spend some time thinking about how physically receptive you are to other people's gestures and eye contact, so as to become more aware of how others perceive you. Do you look away when you're talking to someone or avoid eye contact? Pay attention to your body language. Do you look open to communication, smiling, arms and hands relaxed, making eye contact, or closed, arms tight against the body, fingers clenched, tense in the face, looking away? Again, becoming consciously aware of how you appear to others can only move you in the direction of closer, more intimate connections. Breaking the silence. One of the best things you can do to support your recovery is to begin letting go of the shame of being unloved by breaking your silence and beginning to talk to people you trust about your experiences. This isn't easy. The cultural mythologies and taboos about motherhood make speaking honestly very difficult. Still, breaking your silence is another way of owning your story fully, of validating your experiences and feelings, and no longer participating in the papered-over public version preferred by polite society. Again, share your experiences carefully and judiciously, especially if you are still maintaining a relationship with your mother and other relatives. Musings on recovery. The process of healing from childhood isn't altogether different from the way you felt sitting in a car on a family road trip when you were little. The question that kept rising to the top was, "Are we there yet?" You must keep in mind that your behaviors and reactions were formed in response to literally thousands of interactions, large and small, most of which are beyond conscious recall, and that it's going to take time, patience, and the repetition of new behaviors to replace those old ones. You're basically retraining your brain and your emotional responses. Keep the image of kintsugi in your mind as you move forward so as to keep your expectations realistic without losing any of your hopefulness. The scars we bear can, in time, be seen as emblems of our victories, large and small, over the tyranny of the past. Understandably enough, I'm often asked whether I consider myself fully recovered. My answer is pretty much, because the older woman I am today is nothing like the girl or young woman I once was. Certain things have eluded me, such as a sustaining life partnership, but I'm not sure I can attribute that to my childhood. I know people who had lousy childhoods and who have marriages they've made work. I know people who've had loving parents and great sibling relationships who still struggle with maintaining close connection. The truth is that life is hard, even if you had a loving mother or a good enough one, and that setbacks, disappointments, failures, and real tragedies befall us all. Whether we were loved in childhood or not, all of us are by definition works in progress. We continue to grow and change throughout the lifespan, marked and shaped by experiences good and bad. Be kind to yourself in times of stress, because it's these moments that will test your newly found behaviors and responses the most. In the last chapter, you'll find exercises to help you on the journey. In the meantime, Godspeed. Chapter 10. Engaged Detox. This very last chapter offers the opportunity to put what you've learned by listening into action through thinking and journaling exercises. These are meant to be provocative, to allow you to continue to make sense of your childhood experiences with your mother and family of origin, understand how they affect you in the present, identify the unconscious motivations that drive your behavior today, clarify your thinking, and build up your skill set of managing emotions. They will help you create a coherent narrative of your life and experiences. While most of these exercises involve writing in your journal, they will work best if you spend some time thinking about the questions posed first, unless you're asked to jot down what comes to mind immediately. Listen to the section about journaling in the introduction and heed the admonition about cool processing. A reminder. If you are in therapy, please discuss these exercises with your therapist before doing them. If any exercise triggers anxiety or other symptoms, stop immediately. The exercises are organized by chapter and stage, but since recovery isn't a linear process, you may want to return to earlier exercises if you find yourself stuck or stymied. You may also want to date your journal entries so you can compare and contrast how your responses to certain questions have changed over time. Remember that taking baby steps is fine. They eventually become strides. Discovery Stage, Chapter 1. Please consider